if they can build studios there, soundproofing is a bitch. I mean, there's, it's on Atlantic Avenue by the Barclays Center, the traffic, the motorcycles, the noise outside is formidable. But first, we have to, A, pay for the Empire State Building, our transmitter. It's $53,000 a month and going up, I think, at the end. No, sometime during this year, closer to 60. And then there's rent here, and there's rent at 388, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It costs a lot of money to be a 50,000-watt radio station in New York. And so there are a lot of schemes that will prevent us from being a 50,000-watt radio station in New York. And to quote Walt Kelly, we have met the enemy, and he is us. So we need to beat us. And I'm not asking you to beat us. I'm asking you to pledge $10 a month. 212-209-2950. I'm sorry. Keep going, Robert. Or were you at a pause there?
Oh, yeah. Pause. I was, yeah.
Just the folk scene for me has always been one of the most creative areas. And when I say the folk scene, I know folk music is supposedly hand-me-downs. And yet, among, there are all these people that they call singer-songwriters. Well, Cole Porter was a singer-songwriter. And, well, sort of a singer, but definitely a songwriter who sang his own work. For that matter, so is Stephen Sondheim. But they're not folkies. They belong to a different wonderful music thing. So I've never understood the difference between singer-songwriters like Joni Mitchell and folk singers like Joan Baez. Yeah, where's the line? I guess it's a rhetorical question.
Yeah.
I think they need to, just like science fiction.
Right. And it's the,
it's the wrong word.
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe your writing?
I hate that question.
because you'd be me.
It's because I write fantasy, but if you say fantasy,
then you mean like that dragon Smaug,
right?
All right. Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
that's the deal. We belong to a genre that doesn't have a good name.
Mm. I did write a dragon story that was also a folk singer story once,
ooh,
but I never got it published.
Well, keep sending it out.
I retired it.
Oh. But, it's a trunk story.
Yeah, that's right.
That's what musicians would call something that's in the trunk. I guess writers, it's a drawer story, right?
Yeah.
Nah, so keep sending. New editors.
Mm-hmm.
I'll bet that you were sending it out when most of the venues were print.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Everything that I sent it to is practically dead by now, but I would have to look at it again.
I worked for a magazine, a Hugo-nominated magazine, that's only online.
Mm-hmm.
I edit their podcasts.
Yeah, yeah. But it's a story that actually...
Let me plug it. It's Lightspeed, edited by John Joseph Adams.
Yeah.
Sorry, go on.
No, it's a story that actually that I thought of while at one of the songwriter meetings at Jack's apartment, and then wrote part of it and then came back and read that the next week, but then didn't actually write the story for several years after that, and mm-hmm. then et cetera.
But, I think you should take it out of the drawer, resubmit it. Read it again if you want to change it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, but you have several novels and books out.
Yes. And I have a...
And one coming out in ebook format.
Yeah. Well, I've had some others in ebook, but yeah, the...
Well, I thought I'd promote the latest.
Yes, the latest is all right. The Painting and the City, which came out in a special, nice, beautiful, limited edition hardcover from PS Publishing in England.
Yep.
And never found a U.S. publisher, and then will come out in paperback from PS next year, and ebook. which they were going to do an ebook earlier, and then we all kind of forgot about it. Mm. And
PS is very small.
Yeah.
Independent press, but my God, they are good, and the people there are fabulous. And yes. By the way, people who have helped WBAI more than once, because on request they've sent books for premiums to give out on the air when people pledge. We're not doing that right now. We're premium free this thought, more or less. But
I was also going to say, one of my books, a short story chat book called Psychological Methods to Sell Should Be Destroyed. The cover illustration was done by Tim Robinson, who is also a singer.
I need that book autographed, okay. By the way.
He's also a singer-songwriter, folk singer, who I met at Jack's songwriter meetings. And he does illustrations for New York Times, The Nation, and many, many other publications.
Okay. Yeah, I just picked up that copy you're holding like a week and a half ago when there was a memorial for Electric Velocipede, which I don't like it's being called a memorial.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it should have been called, I know, Sam Miller, you're going to argue with me, but... call it a tribute, because John Klima doesn't know what's going to happen in 5 years.
Right. When his kids are older, he might do something.
Yeah, right now he's trying to have a life.
Yeah.
You know, but, you'll have an empty nest in 20 years, and it'll be time for another bicycle to go electric.
That's right.
So, So that was a great magazine, and they published this more or less, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, because they have their own press.
Right. Published it. Very small type, hard to read.
Yes.
But some of my stories.
But what's there is terse.
yeah.
To paraphrase Spencer Tracy. Let's see. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how to describe your stuff. I would use the Damon Knight definition of science fiction, which I've always loved, and it pinpoints it exactly, and nobody can argue it. Science fiction is what I'm pointing at.
Yeah. I hadn't heard that. That's perfect.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Damon Knight, apocryphally said that. Other people have made claims for other people to have said it, but 90% of the people that know that quote say Damon Knight said it. So I call it the Damon Knight definition, and that's the one that I use on Power of the Wolf when we're talking about science fiction. It's what I'm pointing at.
Okay.
Lord of the Rings, absolutely science fiction, no question about it. I mean, you want to call and then we get into the taxonomy. Is science fiction a subset of fantasy? Well, actually, a very good argument to be made for that. That you have fantasy, stories of, you know, wild imagination, controlled, but imagination, totally of the imagination, of the non-real or surreal. And then science fiction would be a piece of that. Good argument.
Mm-hmm.
And Robert Heinlein, who did not care to be called any of these things, coined the term speculative fiction. People forget that a lot of people use that as a very good, shall we say, touchy-feely term.
Right.
And I like it. It applies, and you can still say it's SF.
Yeah.
And then you tell people, well, you know, that term was coined in 1946 by Robert Heinlein, and they look aghast. It's like you've just, you know, punctured their balloon. I don't know why I like what Heinlein wrote before the 1960s. So it's fair to say I can't even begin to describe what you read last night at the New York Review of Science Fiction.
Yeah. A historical Western detective, surreal, strange, weird story.
Yeah, exactly. that's pretty much it. It's good reading, which is a description, if not a genre. But I think it's fair to say that you write genre for the most part.
Yeah, or I write non-realistic fiction that's...
Actually, there's a good term.
Yeah.
Non-realistic. I don't know why. I've never thought it or heard that. It's such a simple phrase.
Well, simple doesn't work, you know. You need a dissertation, and simple's just too easy. So,
Well, I suppose, but science fiction is a simple term. Fantasy is a simple term.
Yeah.
And they're both wrong. But we use that. But non-realistic is pretty good.
Yeah. Except I want my non-realistic fiction to feel real, sort of. So,
in the sense of the characters and the situations, but not necessarily the settings or events.
Right.
Is that fair?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell us the name of your other books.
The first book I had published was...
I should have brought this with me.
Oh, right.
We can all talk.
I had a first book was a novella called In Springdale Town, which was published also by PS Publishing in 2003. And it wasn't the first book I wrote, though. The first book was my novel Circus of the Grand Design, but it came out second.
Right.
And from Prime Books in 2004, limited small print run vanished, although I got a royalty this year, one sale.
Wow. Prime is another quality independent publisher, we might add. I just like any book I've seen where I've had somebody on the air and they say, oh, I've got this book out from Prime Books. It's like, it's always been quality.
So. Yeah. Yeah.
So.
And after that, this chapbook, which we already talked about, Psychological Methods to Sell Should Be Destroyed, which is actually from a lyric by a band you've probably never heard of, maybe? A punk band called The Minutemen.
You're right. I've never heard of them.
They were from San Pedro, California, got started in the late 70s. At some point in the 80s, 84, 86 probably, their singer guitarist was killed in a car wreck.
Yeah.
They never sold a lot of records, but they influenced a lot of other bands.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked them enough to steal a line.
Yeah, enough to...
whatever you call that.
It's not a homage, a quote.
Yeah.
It's a quote.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of... Effinger wrote a book called When Gravity Fails, and people thought that this would mean people floating off a planet. And no, it's a lyric from Bob Dylan, from Just Like Tom Thumb's Blues.
Uh-huh.
Because Dylan is a poet and a very poetic title, and things that happen in that song are sort of like simpatico with that novel by Effinger, which is a great novel, by the way.
Yeah, haven't read it.
Oh.
No. I've read
I think it would be in your...
Yeah. I've read some of his stuff.
And
met him at a Armadillo Con.
Of course.
When I was in
Texas.
College. He was in Louisiana then, actually, I think.
Oh, Louisiana?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I all I know is he left New York and I was annoyed because he wasn't in New York anymore. He was a constant. And when Hour of the Wolf was on the air 5 days a week, in the early 70s, he was on the air at least every second week, somewhere in there with either the original host, Margot Adler, although I brought him in for Margot, or myself. And In them days, he was called Piglet. there are a lot of people who didn't know that he was George Alec Effinger. Uh-huh. There's a story, no doubt apocryphal, that somebody urged him to read this work by George Alec Effinger. you know, that he should do that. And I took umbrage because for a while I was called Piglet. So, you know, who was the real Piglet among us? Mm. But he lived in a brown house with two WBAI staff members in Brooklyn, as a matter of fact, not far from where the station will move on Pacific Street, which is a mere block where the Pacific meets the Atlantic, a block from Atlantic Avenue. Good writer, good guy. And, yeah, let's do the small world thing. He was in the Clarion Science Fiction Writers Workshop the same year as Margot Adler, who created this show.
Wow. Oh, I didn't know she had gone to Clarion and was writing fiction ever.
No, she's never written fiction. Oh, oh, she just attended Clarion. In, Steve Miller, who was in that same class, as in Steve Miller and Sharon Lee,
yeah.
Told me recently, I've been saying it's 1974, and he says, nope, it's 1973. I look at him and say, how would you know? He said, I was in that class with Effinger and J. Haldeman, Jack C. Haldeman III, and he named all the people, and I guess, okay. And reason that's all important to me is because Adler went to Clarion. Mm. I took over her radio show called Hour of the Wolf.
And wouldn't let her have it back.
Well, I would if she asked. And by the way, I do plan to have her on very, very soon. Because her new book is out! called Vampires Are Us. And she's going to be at LunaCon this weekend, by the way. I should have mentioned, LunaCon is what serves as a New York regional science fiction convention. It moved out of New York City many, many years ago because Star Trek conventions and Comic-Cons had sort of priced science fiction conventions out. And we were looking to... being everybody who attends, but I was a member of the Lunarians, which no longer exists. We didn't want the people coming in pajamas and pointy ears. It doesn't matter that, yes, there's a masquerade, but it's, no, you're not going to meet Bill Shatner, you're going to, you know, meet writers like Robert Freeman Wexler or something like that. And it sort of fell into disrepair. And is starting to make a comeback. And this year's programming is way cool. And I'm on, God help me, 7 items. I like to moderate. I really love to moderate. And Margot Adler will be doing an autograph session and a panel on paganism and a lecture on vampires, which is what her new book is about. So, yeah, she has gotten heavily into vampire fiction. When I say heavily, obsessively. Mm. But no, she went to Clarion. She wrote the stories for each teacher, and she went in a year where the teachers were Le Guin and Joanna Russ and Theodore Sturgeon and Damon Knight and Kate Wilhelm, who created Clarion. This is they called it the Lost Clarion West because there wasn't one the year before or after. And Clarion West only really started sometime after that. And that's when I became the host of this program. So. and now Adler has, well, what's the name of that show? All Things Considered.
Oh, yeah, that.
She slumps. She slumps. But she does not necessarily stay away from WBAI, which are her roots. Actually, KPFA, when she was at college at Berkeley, was the first Pacifica station she worked at. but then she went from Berkeley to New York and became in the news department and created Hour of the Wolf. And made us a 24-hour-a-day radio station. It was she who done it.
Wow.
And then she started doing a show called Unstuck in Time, which I also took over, about the time that she went to NPR full-time. And, she's no longer, there was a time when there were like four people who put ATC, All Things Considered, mm-hmm. together. This was before Morning Edition even existed, and she was one of those. Now she's basically, what's the phrase they use? On staff journalist.
Mm-hmm.
Reporting on, well, she gets to pick her stories. She's one of the NPR originals. So anyway, I promised to promote Lunacon, and that's one way of doing it. Is I'll be doing stuff. My partner Barbara Krasnoff will be reading there, and a good reading track, very good track of people reading fiction. And so hopefully Lunacon will have a renaissance. I compare its politics similar to that of WBAI, which is to say it is totally up. Let's see, where's the list of words? Number three. Okay? There's seven words that you can't say. It is totally number three up. Okay? So, do you go to a lot of conventions?
I haven't in a while.
Used to.
Yeah. Usually World Fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't been to that in about 4 years, I think. Maybe just three. I lost track. 4 years. ReaderCon sometimes.
Yeah, which is where I see you.
Yeah.
When I see you. ReaderCon is probably my favorite convention.
Yeah.
People call it WisCon East. I call WisCon ReaderCon Midwest, because among other things, ReaderCon is older.
Yeah. I went to WisCon several years, but I haven't been to that in a number of years either.
Yeah, WisCon is known primarily as a... is it a feminist, or is it simply a gender-friendly...
Feminist.
It's a
considered,
feminist convention, which is why one major editor got totally... dissed for very hard hitting on certain women at the convention last year. It's not the place. No place is the place. But both ReaderCon and WisCon have had incidents.
Yeah.
Which I'm not going to get into that. Just let's say it's bled over to this year's WorldCon, the coming WorldCon, and who it hosted. Huge controversy. But anyway, and to bring back singer-songwriter, the latest person to weigh in on that controversy is Janice Ian.
Oh, wow.
On her Facebook page. We'll stay away from that.
Okay.
It's messy, folks. It's messy. But it, in some ways, again, parallels some of the history of WBAI, of what is permissible behavior and what is not, and who does it. And are there times when such behavior is permissible, or is it just wrong? Anyway. I'm sorry, I'm pontificating. You should talk more.
Who, me?
You, yes! Yes, you're the guest! And let me remind people, by the way, that this is WBAI in New York City. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me, Robert Freeman Wexler from Ohio. Fine writer of short and mid-length and long fiction. And very, very fortunate in artwork, I must say. Being this being a radio show, we show art.
Yeah, yeah.
At the... here, we're holding it up to the mic. actually, no, I didn't put it up. I should, at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings Facebook page. Mm-hmm. I ought to put the artwork that we had at the gallery last night. It's nice for people to look at if they couldn't be.
Yeah, it was nice.
Yeah. I haven't looked yet to see if the video came out. I know that the audio did.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know you were videoing it. That's neat.
You didn't see me behind the camera five times the entire show?
No, I didn't. I was busy reading, you know. making eye contact
was
with
reading.
The, I was busy worrying about reading.
Yes, exactly. And, she,
and
she
listening
was,
to her.
And she was good.
Yeah, she was great.
She was quite good.
And she's been on the show, hasn't
she? She has been on the show once so far, but will be again. I guess about 3 months ago. Hmm. 3 or 4 months ago.
Well, I could read now. I brought a story to read.
Great. Now, do you want a piece of music beforehand?
Oh, sure.
Or do you want to...
Yeah, yes, music. Then I can go get a drink of water.
Yeah, absolutely. More hearty?
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Why not? Oh, means I have to put on my glasses. Okay, let's take a look. Elevator?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was just telling my daughter about elevator.
Oh, okay.
Because the first line of each song, the first word of each line spells elevator.
Oh, I love stuff like that. Bach used to pull stuff like that. He wrote, there is no H in normal musical lettering, but in German there is. And so... he wrote at least one entire composition that was the notes were B-A-C-H. And John Cage, huge prankster, John Cage. And if anybody wants to fight me on that, I used to engineer him on this radio station. So I will say huge prankster. He wrote C-A-G-E. He also wrote a symphony called... I'm shrugging at the microphone. As if you all know. Okay, everybody out there in radio land, say it along with me. He wrote a symphony called WBAI.
Wow.
He really did.
Wow. So, yeah, Elevator was... I think it came out of one of the songwriters' meetings in whenever it was that song was written to put the word elevator into a song. So that's how he did it.
And Christine Lavin has an elevator song as well, but it's very different. Anyway, here we go.
Spikes, eyes that are always falling asleep, Venus demiloing dislikes. all her collections of lyrics with names, tore holes in her confidence game. Occasionally brightening her day just the same, refusing to mention it by name. Endless numbers lit up as she passed, lifting her spirits like a jet. Everyone said she would never be last, Valentine stuffed in her net. All of us knew she collected us all, temporary insanity or blissfully sane. Only I knew it to be her downfall, refusing to mention it by name.
Jack Hardy, the late Jack Hardy. How long ago did he die?
It's 3 years ago yesterday.
Yeah. And he was not old.
No, 60. Don't remember. But in his 60s. Yeah.
Well, that's
hard. Some kind of cancer in lungs area, something. So,
what can I say?
Nasty.
Yeah, it is. It is.
And I didn't even know about that. I mean, a lot of people didn't. And I had been in and out of touch, and one day looked at Facebook, and it said his, you know, birth and death, whatever. It said March 11th, 2011. And what the hell does that mean? And
Yeah, I found out about people passing in ways like that. I was once on the air. My website, which is ourwolf.com, is hosted by SFFnet, as in Science Fiction Fantasy Net. And when you go to their website and their webmail, they have a little rose there that when somebody's dead, and little balloons when there's a birth to somebody in the community, and a basket or something when somebody wins a major award and things like that. And I was on the air, and I thought I'd just check my email for something in the middle of the show, and I found out that, Jack Chalker, who was a very good friend of mine, had died. I was right on the air. I was devastated. Whatever it was that I was going to do that morning on the show, like, was just thrown out the window.
Yeah.
And I just started mourning right on the air.
Wow.
So, yeah, I know that feeling of finding out through this very removed electronic method of finding out about life and end-of-life events through very impersonal means.
Yeah.
But we get through that same medium, we get to listen to his music.
Right.
And that's a good thing. So, Jack Hardy, folks, enjoy his work. It's still there.
Yeah.
We'll play some more in a while, but also some other things. But are you ready to read?
Yes.
Do you want me to close your mic for a minute? Did it clear the pipes?
Oh, no. Okay. My pipes are good.
Okay, yes.
So, I'm reading an old story, older, that... began in, well, I moved to New York in 1995 and took a writing class with Carol Emshwiller. I had already...
Excuse, That's only a part of the name. You left out the title, the absolutely, utterly wonderful, brilliant Carol, I'm sure.
That's right.
Okay, now you can continue.
Yes. And, I had read some of her writing. She was a friend of people I knew, and someone who I was involved with, and now I am not. So,
although she's still living in New York and all that, at we held her April 12th, I believe it was. We had her 90th birthday party at the New York Review of Science Fiction, from which you came.
Right.
Which is actually, I think, the last time I saw you.
Yeah, which was almost 3 years ago. Yeah, 3 years ago next month.
Okay, that's what I was asking, is how many years ago that was. So Carol's about to be 93.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah, so this began as exercises that she assigned to the class in dialogue writing and point of view, different types of things. And I'd already been writing for a while before that. I'd written a novel, etc. And it was, this was technically a beginning writing class. And even though I wasn't a beginner, I'll always be a beginner compared to her anyway. And it was really great to take a class with her. And then it was able to put that together into this story. It's actually, it's called Tales of the Golden Legend. I usually call it the bread story, or the infamous bread story. People either love it or hate it. It was published, I think, in 2002 or 2003 by the Third Alternative, which is a British magazine published by Andy Cox. It's now called, been renamed Black Static. He publishes Black Static and Interzone, and also another magazine called Crime Wave, can't remember.
Yeah, I didn't realize he was the publisher of Interzone.
Yeah, he bought it from David Pringle. Right. Yeah.
I hadn't realized that.
Yeah.
I hadn't realized Pringle had sold it all.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah.
On the Nightshade message boards, someone, I can't remember which author's message board, this was many years ago, but someone said because of this story they were canceling their subscription, so.
Bravo.
Yeah.
I mean, when John Lithgow was a arts director of WBAI, he did a number of quickie radio dramas, including one all about the death of J. Edgar Hoover on the day Hoover died, where we lost 100 subscribers, and we're proud of that to this day.
Yeah, and John Lithgow is from Yellow Springs, actually.
Is he? Okay.
Unless I'm getting mixed up, but I don't think so.
Okay.
Because I'm not from Yellow Springs, so I don't necessarily know everything. But if you, some Wikipedia list of famous people from Yellow Springs, it's Dave Chappelle and John Lithgow. And
Lithgow. Yeah.
And
everybody says Lithgow because it looks like that.
Yeah.
Spelt like cow on the end, but it's Lithgow.
And for some reason, I'm on the list also.
Again, so I used to fetch coffee. So, you know, I'm the enabler. These people would not, you know. Actually, Lithgow was famous by the time he came to BAI. He had already been nominated for a Tony Award and stuff like that. But nevertheless, he did. He was here for about 2 years, and I appeared on stage with him.
Wow.
Believe it or not. In The Pooh Players. Lithgow played Tigger, and I was, as mentioned,
Pooh. Piglet. Sorry,
I was
sorry.
Piglet. Yes. Bob Fass was Pooh.
Yeah.
Yes, I was Piglet.
Okay, then. So now I'm going to read Tales of the Golden Legend. Prologue. Bread. Remnants of the previous week's snow, hard and blackened, lay in crusty mounds on the sidewalk. An endless flow of pedestrians crunched between the piles. Crossing the street, a man held his hand to his head to keep the wind from removing his hat. The morning sun sent a shaft of light through the windows of the Italian food store. The round semolina loaves, lined up and stacked on the chrome rack, glowed. In their shadow lay rows of baguettes, bagels, rye, and whole wheat. Farther left sat a company of prosciutto, rosemary, and provolone breads. Several varieties of focaccia rested below on a shelf of their own. In front of the shelves, a young, hawk-faced woman with pale skin and blue eyes stood at the cash register. A strand of rusty hair hung over her eyes. She kept batting it back as she waited for a customer. Her father, the fat owner in his white apron, had just unlocked the door and flipped the sign from closed to open. He moved behind the opposite counter to guard his sausages as the first customers of the day entered the store, a pair of women in their mid-70s carrying wicker baskets. "Parmesan," one of them said. "Romano, Romano," the other said, shaking her basket for emphasis. "Anna Felina always buys Romano." The man holding the hat on his head came in and stopped in front of the bread. He gazed at the loaves, entranced, as though he had sleepwalked into the store and awaited a signal to act. Several minutes passed before he lifted his hand from his gray felt hat and removed his black leather gloves. His hair was dark, like pumpernickel, his skin light like the plain bagels. He stood quietly. The hawk-faced woman asked what he wanted. Seeming not to have heard her, he stepped back to allow the old women to pay for their cheese. "And a Tuscan bread," the first woman said to Hawkface in a demanding tone. "Not that one, too small," the second woman said as Hawkface chose the nearest loaf. The man appeared to be listening to something. He stared at the loaves as if they could help him. Finally, after a minute or so, during which time Hawkface ignored him, he pointed to a round loaf of semolina. All of the semolina brightened, glowing like moons. The other varieties grew darker. "Did people bake the first bread, or did bread bake the first people?" the man asked Hawkface as she punched the cash register keys. She looked at him, then at the loaves, and held out her hand for his money. The man paid and left the store. Now smiling as though at a private joke, Hawkface watched through the door as he put his hand back on his hat and crossed the street. The Bread Dialogues. It was morning, a month since I discovered I could talk to bread. I sliced a piece from a loaf of rye and spread some butter. The tea had steeped enough. I tossed the bag and added milk, bit into the bread, began wrapping the loaf in plastic. "You're not going to finish me?" the loaf asked in a musical tone. Because bread is a collective organism, it speaks like a chorus, a blend of male and female. I stopped wrapping and looked at what remained of the loaf. "Not now, I'm full. Maybe later." "But you have to. I'm getting old." "Everybody gets old." "Then put on some music." "I'm about to leave for work." Bread can be demanding. Its age gives it a sense of superiority. There has been at least one loaf of bread existing in the world for 10,000 years since the beginning of agriculture, though maybe longer. The bread isn't sure. "If you won't put music on, I'll sing." I slipped into the bedroom for a shirt, and the bread began singing a song about making a sourdough sponge. "Yeast is in the air, bread is everywhere." I returned to the kitchen. "I'm late for work," I said, interrupting the loaf's singing. "So what? Your job isn't vital." "Bread is right. I keyboard text for a company that publishes books on real estate tax law. I could die and nobody would notice." I looked out the window to check the weather. Gray drizzle. I wound a plaid scarf around my neck. My overwarm apartment always made me forget it was still winter outside. I took the rest of the loaf with me to finish for lunch. The bread kept talking to me on the train to work. "As the protein chains grew in the primordial sea and became the bacteria base of all life, that bacteria was yeast. Yeast was the first being on a planet of rocks and sea. Therefore, all life is bread." This was the second time the loaf had explained bread history to me. I know that yeast is really a fungus, not a bacteria, but didn't feel like arguing. Besides, I'm always careful not to talk to bread in public. The first bread ever to speak to me was a loaf of golden semolina that I bought in the Italian food store after the final argument with Susan, whom I'd been seeing for close to 2 years. When I took it out of the bag and put it on a cutting board, it asked me if I was planning to toast it. I never toast fresh bread. Okay, just checking, you seem upset. I began telling the loaf about Susan, about how I had found out she was having a fling with an English chef at the French restaurant where she worked as a waitress. The semolina said it would let me know if it hurt anything from the baguettes in the restaurant, but I said it didn't matter anymore. Since then, I've talked to at least six or seven loaves, each one different. Heavy varieties like olive breads and anything with meat or cheese don't say much. White breads are the least interesting. Whole grains the most thoughtful. Bagels don't make much sense. Bread has told me that maybe 1 out of 5 million people can understand its language. On the way home from work, I stopped to buy a loaf at a bakery near the office. I tried not to be overwhelmed by the bread sounds around me. The fat loaves of country white complained about the skinny onion baguettes, while a basket of whole wheat rolls laughed at its own jokes. I selected a loaf of something called struan. The label on the shelf said it was made from wheat, corn, oats, brown rice, bran, buttermilk, and honey. It laughed and talked at the same time, a lusty, world-loving voice full of confidence and mirth. I heard it entertaining the other loaves, whistling like the sound of a Baroque flute. On the way home, I bought a newspaper and some fresh mozzarella. "You don't need cheese with me," the bread said from within the bag. I ignored it. We can't always do what bread says. At home, I opened the newspaper and scanned some headlines. I turned toward the loaf and asked, "What's going on in the bread world right now?" "In the Negev, a Bedouin has just pulled a fatir from a saj and handed it to a guest at his tent." "In Austin." "No, that's boring." "Oh, here's a good one." The struan laughed, then continued. "6 blocks from here, a woman just whacked her husband on the side of his head with a long, stale baguette. He's crying, saying, 'She's nothing to me. I love you, honey. I was weak. It was just a fling. Trust me, please. Ha ha ha.'" Bread has told me that the mass-produced loaves found in supermarkets are not alive, not real bread. Injected sponge, it calls them. Bread only comes to life with the slow-rise method. Mix, knead, let rise, punch down, let rise again. "Each loaf is interconnected through its yeast culture," the bread has said. I recently saw a man talking to himself on the train. He spoke with great animation, gesturing to the air in front of him. I thought, is that what it looks like when I talk to bread? The man's hands were empty, but how could I know whether there was something seen and understood by him alone? The sound of crust. I was born at 350 degrees in a small, white gas oven. I first became aware inside this metal box while the yeast died, screaming silently within me. I lay upon a baking sheet, in darkness relieved only by the pulse of flame visible through round holes in the bottom of my oven box. I burned with life. I was alone. Time meant nothing. I had being. I had substance. I wondered, is this life, this metal womb? A sudden light. The door swung down and oven mitts reached toward me. Mother? My creator, a young woman with hair golden like cornflower, pulled me from the oven and slid me from my baking sheet to a wire rack. As I began to cool, I exulted in my newness, stretched the limits of my crust. At this point, I had no notion of those who came before me. I was the universe. Then, the awareness overcame me, the knowledge of all bread. What can I say about the flames that catalyzed my birth that better loaves have not already said? Potatoes are always potatoes. Water boils, cheese melts, but bread alone mutates. Yeast is one form of life, bread another. From bread all life begins and is sustained. Unfortunately, bread baking is not a genetically acquired skill, and I, a round loaf of buttermilk white bread, am the young woman's first attempt. I dwelled too long in her oven. I have air pockets, and my crust is far too thick, too chewy. I know I don't have a rewarding life to look forward to. When she realizes the extent of her failure, she will lose her desire to eat me, and I will mold. Because gestation continues out of the oven, bread should not be sliced for 20 to 45 minutes after birth. So I sit on the rack, awaiting my fate. I can sense her impatience while she paces in front of me. She stops several times and stares at me unfocused, as though looking out from a dream. Her face is soft and round like a hamburger bun. She smiles at me, touches my crust lightly, bends over to smell me. When she leaves the room, I relax. I hear her on the phone. Then I panic. She's inviting someone to come over and share me. I wish the poor woman could understand our language, for I would tell her of her failure. Will she be embarrassed when, with anticipation flooding her senses, watched by her friend, she slices into me? The knife will struggle through my outer shell. She may flatten me if she isn't careful. Then she will see the air pockets. As a white bread, I am sweet, but not deep. Yet I have feelings, and I carry the weight of centuries of bread knowledge, bread awareness. I know the ovens of our past as well as my own birthplace. We have a fondness for brick, for the artistry of a loaf made without controlled temperatures. Sometimes, we think that bread's time has passed. People's lives move too quickly for us, and we do not travel well. She's pacing again. I wonder how far away her friend lives. In 10 minutes, I will be ready for slicing. My crust will make me difficult to eat. Perhaps they will dig out the soft flesh within. Perhaps the young woman's friend will be polite and eat me with feigned enjoyment and much butter. Oh, a horrible thought has come to me. What if they can't recognize that I'm not a good loaf? What if they have no concept of what bread should be? I just realized. I haven't seen her knife. I hope she has the right kind. The edge must be serrated. Pulling a loaf apart with the hands is a natural act, but mutilation with the wrong knife is agony. I fear I will be crushed beneath the clumsy pressure of an inexperienced hand and an improper blade. What will happen to me, I wonder, after these initial slices, while I, still warm, am the center of their food world? All bread grows cold, changes in texture. A mediocre bread becomes worse. Will I sit, forgotten on the shelf until I turn rock-like, or into her too small freezer to chill the life from me? Like trying to tell time from a sundial left in the shade, bread is useless if not eaten. A knock at the door and she runs into the living room to open it. They kiss. He makes dutiful compliments about my appearance. I'm worried now. The first slice is always difficult. The waiting, and then the cutting. Where is the knife? I must see it. Good. They have a real bread knife. 12 inches long with a seductively curved wooden handle. I palpitate. I wait. He takes it out of the cardboard packing, runs tap water over it, dries it. He's ready. The expectation is killing me. He hands it to her. No, she gives it back. Please, please, I'm ready. Let me feel it. Finally, he begins the first cut. The arm comes down. Knife edge presses my crust. Ah, he's experienced. He turns me on my side. I can't breathe. I can't think. His hands, delicate, like those of an artist. I wish he would hold me forever. The new knife bites. I feel it. Back and forth, back and forth. He saws with precise strokes. Yes, yes, I feel it. I can't take it. I don't want it to end. Oh, 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 I can't. I don't. I can't. Ah, it's over now. They're eating. I can rest. Epilogue, Bread Aria. In the sky, a lone cloud slid across the blueness, borne along by the breezes of the young spring. The late afternoon sun shone just over the tops of the buildings. A man coming out of an apartment building squinted and probed his shirt pocket. He pulled out a pair of sunglasses and slid them over his eyes. On the way to the crosswalk, he sidestepped a puddle of rusty water that had accumulated from a dripping fire hydrant. Inside the Italian food store, Hawkface watched a boy in his mid-teens bring several fresh loaves of ciabatta from the oven. She pushed a few whole wheat baguettes aside to make room. The ciabatta thanked her for giving them a spot near the cash register. She didn't respond. She stood leaning with her elbows on the counter, staring at the cheeses and sausages in the glass case opposite her. Few customers had come in that afternoon. She kept looking at her watch. Her eyelids, colored a metallic blue, drooped over her pupils. Her chin kept bobbing as she fought off afternoon drowsiness. Behind her, the new ciabattas, their voices purring like cats, chatted with their neighbors. They discussed the corn muffins in the basket on the counter. One loaf described them as sweet nothings of negligible nourishment. The focaccia, always pushing their pedigree, spoke in haughty tones about the quality of the mushrooms baked into their tops, while the prosciutto bread, sated by its own flavor, said nothing. Hawkface continued to stare at her watch. Without lifting her head, called out once to the fat man behind the cheese counter. "So damn bored, I wish a bus would drop a load of tourists at our door." A woman with a green scarf over her head came in with a young girl. Hawkface stood up straight and smiled, her first smile of the day. "Either that or ice cream, but only ice cream with chocolate chunks," the girl said to her mother. "Not chocolate ice cream. Or maybe an apple turnover and ice cream. I'll get you something sweet, but you can't have it till after dinner." "Fine, Mama, but I don't want eggplant again. We've been having eggplant all this long winter, and I'm sick of it. Sick of it, sick of it." The man with the sunglasses entered. He dropped the glasses back into his shirt pocket. The breads greeted him by name. "Stephen," they said. He smiled, but walked to the back of the store, where he selected cartons of milk and orange juice. When he returned to the bread, the multigrain was singing the part of Tamino from the magic flute. "O endless night, wilt thou never pass? When shall my eyes behold the light?" The ciabatta, in chorus, answered, "Soon, young man, or never." While the man with the scarf paid for a focaccia and an apple turnover, the girl stared at the bread and giggled. Her mother and Hawkface apparently couldn't hear the singing, which was so loud now it would have drowned out their comments about the weather. The girl began humming along with the bread and continued humming as her mother led her out. The man stood looking at the bread, which had stopped singing. He idly played with a strand of his dark hair. The semolina bread whispered to its neighbor that they knew the man would pick one of them. The multigrain, in a commanding tone, told them to hush. "We'll order something already before I fall asleep," Hawkface said. She smiled. The man smiled back. He continued to stand before the bread, which began asking in turn, "Choose me. What about me? Am I the right flavor? Choose me." The semolina glowed as he asked for one of them. The man left the store. Hawkface turned to watch him through the window while he crossed the street. The remaining loaves resumed the singing. For a moment as she watched, he paused to allow a taxi to turn in front of him. With a pile of baguettes between her and the window, his head seemed to be connected to the bread. The loaves became his body. She shook her head as though emerging from a dream. And the end. Thank you. Thank you.
I'm okay with numbers. Chances are I'll bury you. But not yet, it's just too early and there's lots of shit to do. There's the business of the bending of the language into song, and the drinking of our sorrows and the hanging on too long. To a woman's raging beauty, to the thunder on the hill, and your body may cry uncle, but your spirit never will. So here it is, Ash Wednesday, and all things dust to dust. Still I'm begging you to linger while I'm begging you to trust that there is some kind of forever where your brothers wait for you, and a fine roper saddle and that Colorado blue. But that's all for tomorrow, for today is good enough to live a little longer here in our relentless love. For you and your wonder at the stories in our bones, you laughing so easy and then driving on alone. As always, through some darkness to where the darkness parts, back to the beginning where the next song starts. Jack of Hearts.
Tim Robinson, artist, and so we did figure out that song, in fact, does have something to do with Jack.
Yes, yeah, it was his tribute. He wrote after Jack died.
Yeah, and a nice song on its own. But that story, I mean, come on, people. It's a lovely story. It's a hilarious story filled with yeast infections and bread orgasms and too many puns that can be made for that, you know, like going out for a roll or stuff. I got to tell listeners, if you agree with me and love that story, pledge to WBAI, because who else would broadcast a story like that?
That's right. And if John Klima still has copies left for sale...
I believe he does.
It is in Psychological Methods to Sell Should Be Destroyed, which is only $5.
Yeah, and it's a whole chapbook. It's a nice chapbook.
Ordered from Spilt Milk Press, Electric Velocipede, and...
Yeah, if you Google up Electric Velocipede, that's probably the easiest. And John Klima is K-L-I-M-A. Yeah. And he actually came in to New York for that memorial.
For his wake.
for the wake, yeah.
Yeah.
Where at the end of the thing, Sam Miller, after the last reader had read, said, time of death. 8:05. So it's like no, you know, I'm not buying it for a second, John. You know, it is merely in cold storage. The magazine is still available for download.
Right.
So one can still get Electric Velocipede, and you had some stories in there.
Yeah, one in. I don't remember which issue. Number eight.
What was the cover? I remember them not by the number, but by
cover
the...
had a bicycle on it.
Okay. I mean, there weren't that many that had bicycles, but it was a Velocipede, right?
Story by Jeff Ford and Rick Bowes, co-written with Mark Rich.
Okay. Story. Which he read from at the event, which I filmed, by the way. I filmed that event as well, and I haven't looked at the film from last night's reading. When I say film, of course, I mean video.
Yeah.
But the video of the Electric Velocipede event is just top notch.
Great.
My partner read there as well. She was in one of the you can't single out any issue because they're all filled with one. But she was in an issue with Jeff Ford and Rick Bowes and lots of people. The one with the blue cover and the two silhouetted hands. He's showing it on the air. that was a spectacular issue. And Barbara Strain, that was good. But anyway, but all the stuff in that in Velocipede was great. And I'm just not, you know, I can buy that John has to move away from it, raise his daughters, who are, I think, like 6 and 8.
Yeah.
Something like that.
No. Well, I don't remember.
Or even younger, possibly.
Older.
Older.
Well, no, I can't remember. I think one is younger than my daughter and one is older.
Uh-huh. How old's your daughter?
Six.
Six, okay.
So, everything in my life is based on her age, because that's the only way I can remember things.
Yeah, well, that's the main thing in your life.
Yeah.
And needs to be, which is why John had to move away from the magazine for now. But, you know, at some point, as I say, there's going to be, at some point, maybe you'll put out a magazine called Empty Nest or something or other. I just don't buy that something as good as Electric Velocipede that John won't at some point. One hopes, one can only hope. But I got a T-shirt, I got your chapbook there, and actually I have all the issues.
Yeah,
but I didn't have your chapbook, so I got that from him there, which I was very pleased.
Did he still have the Bill Shun chapbook, or did you already have that? Because I thought he sold out of that.
No, I didn't see any there, and Bill was there.
Yeah.
And believe me, Bill would have been hawking it had he been there. Bill is now at least back in New York City. He flew the coop for a while, lived in the second city.
Yeah.
Where he was, it was really weird. He was running his own interstitial style reading series. It was poetry and science fiction and music. First Tuesday of every month, just like the New York Review of Science Fiction readings. And it's like, why are you competing with me? I don't care if it's in Chicago. And sure enough, I invited him to come over to a New York Review of Science Fiction reading and do something. Well, after he moved to New York, he said, oh, I can't. I've got to fly to Chicago to host
my reading. Still doing it?
No, not now. No,
okay.
But this was a couple of months ago.
Right.
And he's finally, like, I think he's figured out that the round trip fare, well, I don't know if he's training or flying or what. I know he's not driving, but the trip to Chicago was not worth the expense of hosting a monthly event.
Yeah, we talked about Mike coming to Chicago to do it, and it never worked out.
Oh,
it's about a 5-hour drive for me.
Yeah,
so not bad. It's just Tuesday night though. You know, it didn't work out. But it sounded like
Chicago isn't that bad. Yeah.
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 So.
I can see that. I think I've even once, not done it because at that time I didn't drive, but I was bopping around the country with a friend of mine going to different conventions, and I believe we made that hop.
Yeah.
And I've actually been in more Ohio cities than I have any reason to, partly because I also took training at CompuServe.
Where were they?
I think it was Columbus.
Okay.
As opposed to Cincinnati. All I know is I get into a cab that's going to take me to CompuServe headquarters, and the guy said, you know, we've got the highest crime rate per capita than anybody else in the country.
Probably so. Cincinnati. Though,
so it's maybe. Probably
Cincinnati. I don't know. I didn't know it was there at all.
No, if it had been Cincinnati, I would have gone to a bowl game.
Yeah. Yeah, probably. I would have thought Cincinnati's crime rate was worse, but I don't know.
Well, yeah, but I was something really... Well, as they say, as Casey Stengel used to say, you could look at a CompuServe was not a minor service. This is before AOL bought it. And I wasn't working for CompuServe. I was running an online service, or one of the people running one for Ziff Davis Publishing, ZiffNet, not ZDNet, as it morphed when it got bought by CNET, but ZiffNet. Let's put it this way, before the web. and that, and we were involved in the birth of the web, because one of our consultants is a guy named Tim Berners-Lee, Berners-Lee being a hyphenated name, and he is the inventor and creator of the web and the HTTP protocol.
Wow.
Yeah, it's like, I'm always astonished people don't know this guy's name.
Yeah, I've never heard of him.
It's like, you know, name somebody who changed the lives of everybody in the latter 20th century, and his creating the web and putting it into the public domain, I dare say, has affected more lives than many, many, many heads of state.
Yeah.
But nobody knows who this guy is. He's now Sir. Some people know who he is. They knighted him.
Yeah.
And it wasn't the U.S. who knighted him, although he's at MIT. But anyway, this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored on Commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM and at WBAI.org. It's not ARG, but ORG. It's ARG only on Speak Like a Pirate Day. We've got like 15 minutes left, believe it or not.
Wow.
Time does fly.
Mm-hmm. Wait. I wanted to say Karen Warren in Australia.
Two A's in Warren.
Was going to tune in after her son's dentist appointment.
Okay. So it's morning,
yeah,
right?
It's 4 p.m. there.
Wow, it's afternoon.
It's tomorrow.
Good day. No,
yeah.
Yeah, well, I had some people from WIDA, from the special effects crew, when Lord of the Rings was making the Two Towers. We actually did a broadcast talking to a bunch of people at, not Australia, but New Zealand.
Yeah.
Kiwis. Had a bunch of Kiwis on the air. And it was like, yeah, no problem. It's good day.
I was just going to say, Karen, if you did make it to streaming, listening, hi.
Yeah, and besides, the show's available on stream for 2 weeks. Mm. Everybody should remember that. You go to archive.wbai.org, and that's our Wayback Machine. Mm. Yeah, I've always said that for years and years, and now that there's this not very good-looking Mr. Peabody and Sherman movie out there that you know does the Wayback Machine in a very well non-Jay Ward manner. I feel funny, but we're available by the Wayback Machine. You can listen to the show for a couple of weeks at archive.wbai.org or go to ourwolf.com and you'll see a link there. Why don't you put on your headphones and we can invite people to talk to Robert Freeman Wexler at area code 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900. And good morning, you're on the radio.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Mr. Wexler, that would make a great food fable.
Yeah.
That's a great fable. That really is. Are you a bread lover?
Oh, well, yes.
I think that sort of came through.
I thought
in the course, no pun intended, of the story.
I thought any minute you were going to throw in lembas and naan and Portuguese sweetbread and pan dulce just for added fun. Oh, God, I love
that. Would be a non-starter.
Yeah, very good, James, very good. As to your reading last night, and I must tell you, I think I was absolutely riveted by what you read last night, and since I had a long ride home, I was trying to think of how to type you, and I said, you can't. Would you be upset if I called you interstitial?
No, although I did just submit a story to the interstitial anthology, and it was rejected.
Oh, well, you never know.
But the editors change every year, so you can submit it again next year.
I was thinking that story of yours, and I said this to you last night, I wish we'd had more time to talk, that story of yours would have been perfect at a WWA convention. And it would have been great to nominate it for a Golden Spur. And I was thinking of writers.
I'm sorry, what is the WWA?
Western Writers of America, of which I'm a bona fide member. Anyway, the point was that I was thinking of writers. And on the way home, I came up with a writer that you reminded me of. Joe R. Lansdale.
Mm, interesting.
Lansdale is, yeah. Well, he writes weird westerns.
Right.
I mean, among many other
yeah,
things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hmm. But that was definitely, I mean...
That's high praise. He's a good writer.
Yeah,
well, he
is,
and, yeah. And he does write weird westerns, and they're set in all sometimes grotesque environments. And I would love to know whether, well, first of all, I'm curious, why did you pick the Gulf Coast area of Texas as opposed to, say, the Big Bend or the Big Thicket or the Central Hill Country?
Because I'm from Houston, which is Gulf Coast, so
right.
It was more...
You had to know he was near KPFT, yeah. Near our sister station.
Yeah.
Did that part, I'm curious, because you mentioned the great hurricane that wiped out Indianola in 1885,
yeah.
Of which I've read. Was that part of Texas engulfed in as much conflict as other parts of the state were in the late 19th century? Do you know?
I don't know.
Okay.
There's a lot of stuff about 19th century New York. Yeah. I've got no idea about
it. No, actually, it was a great reading. I just hope that you'll finish it soon, and it will be out, because, as I say, it was fascinating, and, as I say, definitely crossover literature.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and it sounds like you actually have.
And tonight's story could have been a cross bun over. I'm sorry, that story was just too...
I want to say
ripe for puns and stuff.
Well, I mean...
but bread doesn't ripen.
Right? You know, I must say this. Bread has a great deal of traditional and oral literature around it. There are many cultures that have origin stories of bread.
I know, it's just that you said oral literature.
Yeah.
That's O-R-A-L, James.
Oh, I thought it was A-U.
No, but definitely there are a lot of stories. In fact, there was a book, I think unfortunately it's out of print now, it was put out by the County Society in Britain many years ago called The Folklore of Britain. It went into all manner of original myths and legends of different countries and different cultures. But I was absolutely fascinated. And besides that, your story made me very hungry, Mr. Wexler. Now I'm going to have to go and chomp down some sourdough.
Time to go to the larder.
Yes. Anyway, good luck, and I hope we see you again soon.
Thanks.
One last question. You mentioned Ohio, and you come from Ohio. Have you ever heard of a town in that state called Waynesville?
Yes.
Waynesville, by all accounts, according to a woman who's a ghost huntress in Ohio, the dean of ghost huntresses out there, says it is the most haunted town in the entire state.
Wow. I didn't know that.
If she's not the one haunting it.
She actually put out a number of collections of Ohio ghost stories. Mm-hmm. The last I count, heard was five or seven.
I've seen some of those. Yes. So
and,
that's her, yeah.
And she mentioned that Waynesville was the most haunted town in Ohio.
I've actually heard that from Chris Barzak, who's another Ohio writer.
Yeah.
There are a whole bunch, Tobias Buchel, a whole bunch of Ohio writers.
So good luck to you.
Thanks.
And we hope to see you again soon. And thank you for a lovely, very edifying story.
Thanks. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Okay. And edifying is, in fact, an appropriate word for it. If you'd like to call up and speak with Robert Freeman Wexler, whether or not you were at the reading last night at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, the telephone number here is area code 212-209-2900. And we have a very weird phone system here, and sometimes when we get more than one call at a time, the second, third, and fourth calls drop off. So if you are calling now, I suggest hang up and call back. But we actually only have, at this point, 10 minutes left, because I have to play outro music and all that. But that was just delightful. I mean, I cannot imagine why anybody would threaten to close their subscription to a magazine for a story of that much fun with Molly Bloom like references. I was waiting for the bread to say yes, I will.
Funny, because I haven't looked at this story in years, but reading back through it, seeing all these little bits and pieces of New York when I lived here.
Mm-hmm.
And the Italian food store I talk about, which isn't exactly the way I describe it, of course, because it's fiction, but it was at corner of Grand and Mulberry, and it's not there anymore.
Mm.
Part of the sign is still there, because I think it's tile or something, it's farther up, but now it's in the process of being turned into some, you know, new, because everything in, you know, everywhere is
everything
getting
turned over,
into some
in new
York. Something.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I mean, I have to point out to people, in fact, one time I was traveling to WBAI when we were on Wall Street, from the West Village, having picked up an editor by the name of Datlow and a writer by the name of Bose, and we had to wend through the various streets. And I'm taking a look at this point, and we passed a building, and about the fifth floor of the building was Five Corners Dentistry. And Rick, who knows... Well, first of all, he knows everything.
Yeah.
But in addition, and any time I've tried to catch him, he's been right. I mean, I've really, really tried to, you know, he'll make some... I'll play one of my favorite Natalie Merchant songs, Come Take a Trip on My Airship. And he says, oh, yes, it's an old Irish song from Boston from 1911 and all that. And it's like, oh, please, oh, come on, give me a break. And I check it out. I mean, it was on Boylston Street, yeah, for God's sake. It was exactly 1911. Yeah. He named the tenor. God, Bose's. Let's not. He's amazing. Mm. But anyway, we're going by there, and we figured out exactly, while the cab was, you know, waiting, exactly where in the middle of this huge building that's there, where the Five Corners were. They purposely, totally covered it up. As of course, I mean, there is no more canal on Canal Street,
yeah,
because somebody decided cholera wasn't a good thing for New York City, and was a cause of more than one epidemic.
Yeah.
In New York, Canal Street itself. I mean, it later on had a reputation for sailors and other things, but cholera was... And all that. I love gone places in New York. I never pass by the Emigrant Savings Bank near the KGB bar where the Fantastic Fiction series is held without tipping my hat to the Fillmore. And all that. So.
Yeah. There's a great... blog website called Forgotten New York.
Yeah.
That, yeah. Which it's actually sad blog because it's
a
all
very
about
sad blog. Yeah.
Everything that's
and what's as sad is it continues to grow.
Yeah.
I mean the website, which isn't just that they're discovering old things; it's that some of the good newer things and 20th century things just disappear and go away.
Yeah.
So, but it's fabulous stuff. Simon Lokely here of WBAI and Gordon Linsner, who is a science fiction fantasy writer and editor in the New York area, has been on the show a few times, are both tour guides. And it's just wonderful to... talk with them, and I remember sitting with one of them and would just say, oh yes, such and such used to be here.
Mm.
Again, the same thing with Rick Bose.
Yeah.
He'll tell, we do the reading series at 138 Sullivan Street. And he said, oh yeah, yeah, there was an Italian club over here.
Well, yeah.
That's before his time, but he knows this.
Yeah,
stuff.
He knows that. We were today, or actually yesterday, having coffee, and somehow Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr came up, and he was, you know, Aaron Burr's farm was just up the block here.
Not only that, another science fiction person, I'm blanking on his name, wonderful writer has been on the show, Lawrence from Washington, D.C. He writes under a lot of pseudonyms. He's got 30 books out.
Schimmel?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, it's not Lawrence Schimmel, no. It's a hyphenated person. Oh. But his family had the farm next to Aaron Burr's and was there for years and years. And I live in the neighborhood of his nemesis, Fort Hamilton. So I think WFMU is near the grounds where they had their duel in Jersey. So
yeah,
it all ties together. So we need to tell people where they can get your stuff. You know, what books are available, some of them electronically, some physically. You don't have a website, do you?
No, I do.
Oh, you do?
You read it out last
time. Oh, I did.
In my bio.
Of course. Robert Freeman Wexler, WEXLER .com. You can figure out the Robert and Freeman for yourself. But yes, I did do that last night.
Right.
All of a sudden, Oh, I know what it was. I make the mistake of searching for you by the full name sometimes. And sometimes you just use Robert Wexler.
Yeah, and get the congressman, or former congressman.
Yes, former controversial, wasn't he? Didn't he have something?
I don't think
so. No?
Remember, his district was the infamous butterfly ballot district in Florida.
Uh-huh.
Was part of it.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
So his middle name should be Chad.
Yeah.
The hanging Chad. A bit that will always be remembered. People can go to robertfreemanwexler.com.
Yeah, and find information there. Two of my books are an e-book, The Circus of the Grand Design. It's still in print, and it's an ebook from Infinity Plus eBooks.
Right.
And also in Springdale Town, which is out of print in paper form.
Yeah, and that's e-book. Again, the cover of that is just magnificent.
Yeah, it's great.
Although I think, I dare say, if I can go so far, your best cover is the painting in the city.
Great, thanks, which I did.
That's right. That's right.
Under a pseudonym, which you have to read the book to understand.
Right, which I did. Right after you did a KGB reading, not that many years ago, comparatively speaking.
Yeah.
Was that about 4 or 5 years ago?
August 2009, I think.
Okay, that's 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah,
I remember because I sat at the table where I'm always sitting recording, which I can't do anymore because it's on the same night as this radio show.
Yeah.
So Gordon Linsner, the aforementioned, does the recordings for us.
Yeah.
And I helped your wife sell the books.
Yeah.
Which is a lot of fun, actually. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a book that, people can get the e-book, but I hope that if they sell the e-book, they sell a high-res version
of
that cover.
And I think, the paperback, I think, is going to have a different cover art, which is was an interior illustration. I shouldn't even be saying this yet. We haven't asked the artist. Jason Van Hollander did some interior illustrations and was thinking of using one of those as the cover because in the French edition, the French used it as the cover, and I thought that was a great idea. It's one of the ones you had on the wall of the sort of upside-down ship.
Yes.
And the French publisher put that on the cover, and I thought, wow.
Yeah. If people ever come to the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, you'll find we actually use the digital gallery as a digital gallery. We put, basically slides up.
Mm-hmm.
And it works very nicely. You have 16 screens. We're done, believe it or not. Yeah, we're done. Can you hear the music coming up in the background? Steel Ice Pan. With Sails of Silver. Well, it took long enough to get you here. and we'll need to make it, you know, more frequent or whatever. Yeah, I canceled that once because I was sick, and you told me that, and I'm remembering now how obnoxious.
Yeah, really.
Well, you're here, and we've got the recording of you last night.
Yeah, great.
So we'll figure out how to utilize that. But thank you again for being here.
All right, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
It was fun. Good. So fun, despite being late or early or
it's both.
Something.
Yeah. And Lister will not be coming in this morning with Burn Baby Burn Clapper. Instead, we've got some program, Natural Medicine, on recording coming up. And stay tuned for that. I trust that you will find it interesting. And this is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. I'll be on next week from 1:30 till 3. And unfortunately, our scheduled guest, David Edison, have to move the date. So we'll reschedule him and have him here very soon. And if you're coming to LunaCon, I'll see you there. So thank you again, Robert.
Thank you.
And everybody, have a good morning. And this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
Sister, you've been on my mind. Oh, sister, we're two of a kind, so sister. I'm keeping my eyes on you. I bet you think I don't know nothing but singing the blues. Oh, sister, have I got news for you? I'm something. I hope you think that you're something too.
And our guest today is Dr. Gwen Scott, a naturopathic doctor and former CNN news anchor. Dr. Scott is a master herbalist who has studied with the prominent alternative medicine practitioner, Dr. Deepak Chopra, and she has also studied with traditional healers in the Latino, Hispanic, and Native American communities. Today we have a must-have 3-DVD set in which Dr. Scott offers simple and easy natural remedies for some very common ailments. So if you'd like to learn how to stop a cold or flu in its tracks, cure an earache, eliminate scars, or make your own rescue remedies, this is something that you're going to want to have. Welcome, Dr. Scott.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's so good to be talking to you. When you see articles or specials about irradiation, one of the things that the mainstream media says is that irradiation is harmless, and that in scientific studies, if you compare non-irradiated food to irradiated food, that it's the same, it has the same value, the same molecular structure. Many people don't buy it and are, you know, we're not consuming food that was labeled irradiated when these things were first coming out. And so obviously they've gone back to the drawing board on forcing their consumers. But really, what happens to food? What is irradiation and what happens to food when it's irradiated?
Well, you know, you don't have to be a nuclear rocket scientist, whatever, surgeon, to figure out that radiation, we use it to kill things, period. And when these nutrients in our foods, the enzymes, the vitamins and minerals, are very delicate. And in microwaving is the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we embraced that technology because it got things on the table more quickly, but now we're looking at physicists and all kinds of scientists saying, you know, it so rearranges the molecular structure that your body, and it's perhaps one of the reasons Americans are struggling with weight like they are. And one physicist called it food wad. He said, you know, it may look like broccoli or whatever, but when it goes into your system, your body doesn't know what it is because it's been so molecularly changed and altered.
Mm.
So it sort of stores it, as he called it, food wad or fat.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen this where, Natalie, I've asked people, just tape your microwave closed for a month and see how your weight does. And they all report, in varying degrees, weight loss.
And this is because of the way the molecular structure of the food has changed from either radiation by irradiating food or the radiation from a microwave?
Exactly. They're different. They're different.
Mm-hmm.
But they all essentially do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Which
zap,
is
and we use the word zap, nuke. Somewhere deep inside of us, we know this is not the way we want to do our foods. And to me, the most important aspect of this is choice. We should have a choice. If we want organic foods unmolested, we should be able to get them. We should not have it mandated to us.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you can grow your own, that's the way to go. If you know a local organic farmer, but most people don't. They go to the health food store and depend on those folks, you know, to bring their fruits and vegetables in a fairly clean, non-chemical, non-altered whole food state.
Mm-hmm.
And this will change that dramatically.
The Natural Medicine Survivor's Guide 3D DVD set, and it really shows us the value in something like this, because for so many of us who, well, there's several aspects. One, when you think about laws like the Food Safety Modernization Act and facing limited choices, less choices, it becomes more essential to know how to take care of yourself naturally. It becomes more clear why something like a Survivor's Guide to Natural Medicine is important for people. And so, you know, I'm sure that you started putting this together before things like food safety modernization were on the horizon, just out of wanting to share what you know and what you understand, what you see people need as a practitioner. But times have changed, and this is now actually becoming critical and coveted, and maybe even one day contraband information that you've put together here in the Natural Medicine Survivor's Guide.
Yeah, you know, I had what they say, rumors of war. I saw this happening, and I was hearing rumors from other countries, and I could see what was happening in this country, the systematic removal of all of our freedoms that we so cherish. And, of course, in my end of the world, that means natural medicines and herbs and good food. And so I had spent 30 years really working, as you said in the introduction, with all of these. And I don't want to forget the African-American community either, because I spent a good time in the Mississippi Delta working with some very old healers there. And what I've tried to do is go back to the basics, find things that are available to everyone that cost pennies. I hate elitist medicine. It's sacred. It wasn't ever meant to be a cash cow. And that did the job and did no harm. And I would say at this point, Natalie, anytime we do anything new in our healthcare regimen, we should be working with a practitioner. I mean, that's just the way we should be doing it, especially if we're taking any over-the-counter pharmaceutical drugs, because even the most benign herb will contraindicate with some of these drugs. So the pharmacist is your point person.
Mm-hmm.
They know which ones contraindicate with what herbs and supplements. An example, if you're on heart meds, most of them you should not even get near grapefruit, which is a pretty nutritious, benign thing. But when combined with this drug, causes problems. So always, no matter what, work with a healthcare, a professional healthcare practitioner. I have to say that because it's really true. I put this together from my heart and soul because I did feel these days were coming, I'm sad to say, and that people would be a bit lost if most people in this country got into natural or alternative, it's called, medicine. Once everything was up and running, prepackaged, pre-prepared, go to the health store, it's all there for you, there are books, you know. But what happens if that all goes away? Where are the roots? Well, that's what I've spent 30 years doing, is finding the roots to all of these prepackaged, pre-prepared, nicely presented. But if they go away, what would you do? You wouldn't know. So that's what this DVD, it's over 4 hours. You know, I was laughing once, I thought, War and Peace. I didn't realize when I started it would be so much information. I didn't realize.
It's phenomenal. It really is. I mean, I'm really impressed. I've gone through the DVDs, and you packed so much information in here. And as I was watching, I was thinking, you know, I'm a trained herbalist, and I've also managed a holistic healthcare center. And so when I first saw the set, I thought, okay, you know, you see so many materials, new books, new box sets, and half the time they really don't have that much to offer. Or you cringe when you hear the things that they're sharing with people. And so I did not have high expectations when I popped in the DVDs. And what I kept saying as I watched you and listened to you, I was like, that's right on point. This is exactly the kind of stuff that I love sharing, especially when I was a practicing herbalist, seeing clients. You know, I also called it kitchen medicine, and I also called it grocery store medicine. But the stuff that I love to share with people is the stuff that you can either roll right out into your yard and pick, or for those of us who don't have a lot of access to land, we can roll right into the grocery store, go to the produce aisle where the herbs and the roots are, and pick so much medicine. And I remember when I would share that with people, because one of the things that puts people off sometimes about natural medicine is that it's become a commodity, a very pricey commodity. And so a lot of times people just don't even get started because they think, oh, I don't have any more money to spend on, you know, going and buying these supplements and these herbs, and, you know, I'll just stick with what I've got going. And the great thing about kitchen medicine and grocery store medicine and garden medicine is that, like you said, it's pennies on the dollar, it's very accessible, it's very simple, and it's incredibly empowering. You know, when you are, you know, in a bind, you feel a virus coming on, and instead of, you know, having to go down to the drugstore and part with, you know, $10, $15 for something over the counter or even more, if it's a prescription, when you can go into the grocery store and for a few dollars, you know, buy an herb or a root and take it home and make a tincture or a tea or an oil extraction, and you're better, you know, you just feel yourself getting better right when you start to take it. That feeling of not only, you know, am I getting better on my own, but it's, I'm getting better naturally, I'm getting better with something from the earth. That whole combination is so empowering, and you don't have that drug hangover that you can sometimes have when you take these medications that make you drowsy or have side effects like, you know, your stomach hurts. You know, you have a new problem is often what happens, is you trade one for another.
All drugs, whether they're pharmaceutical, over-the-counter prescription, have a toxic nature to them. And it's in varying degrees, some extremely toxic.
Well, and I also remember recently there was a whole scare with the children's versions of those kinds of medicines.
Yeah.
And I guess several children and infants had died from taking the children's version. And then all of a sudden there was this giant recall. And, you know, one week it was like, don't give them to your kids. The next week it was give these particular brands. And you think to yourself, okay, if you just told me that children are dying, why am I even going to go back from recall mode into, you know, this particular lot is safe? So I think that at this point, consumers feel like they want an alternative. They need sound information. They need something affordable. And that's what Natural Medicine, a Survivor's Guide, is giving us. So I just want to remind everybody that we are in Fund Drive, and that Dr. Gwen Scott is the creator of Natural Medicine, a Survivor's Guide. It's a three DVD set that we're offering today for your pledge of $150. 4 hours of just pure education, but not just education, practical education. It's how to. She's not standing on a pedestal saying, you should do this, you should do that. She's got her sleeves rolled up. She's right in front. She's got everything in front of her, all of the materials you need. She holds everything up for you. You can see it clearly in the DVD. And she shows you, she walks you through the steps of how you can use this, the scenario.